the studies program department at the DWC, the African Gender Institute here, and the Gender Equity Unit. And it is in honor of Patricia McFadden, who we've just appointed at DWC as the Professor Extraordinaire. And it was time to appoint the radical black fins. And I think this is the first of many to come. So sometimes you start with mediocrity, but maybe I should. Okay. So welcome, Pat. And I think we've got an order to do things. We will do the masculine thing earlier tonight. And we'll ask.
I agree with that.
And we ask the guests to say something to introduce them.
Thank you, Mary. It's a great pleasure and an honor to welcome and introduce Patricia McFadden, who is our new extraordinary professor. Patricia I've known for many, many years. And I don't know, for me, it's by knowing Pat, I've learned to really understand what it means to think about the personal being political. And I mean, I know we all know that that's a cliche of feminism, but it's a cliche, unfortunately, that's been rapidly disappearing. Patricia has always worked at aligning her theorizing with her lived experience, how she lives her life. And I've constantly felt challenged, I've constantly felt a lot of discomfort, but there's this kind of pushing to do more. And I think that this is what she's going to bring to UWC. Yesterday, I think it was, when was it yesterday, that Pat came to the GEU and worked with some of the students, people like Ashraf and Tommy. And I thought, okay, you know, it's the end of the year, they're exhausted, they want to move on. So I thought, okay, it's going to be an hour. And an hour went, and they were still talking. Then I left, and I came back, and they were still talking. And I left, and I phoned, and I think it went on for about, two and a half hours. People that Pat is bringing to UWC, and we look forward to it lasting a very long time. So welcome, Pat, and thank you very much.
Thank you. I really feel like I stand in front of this masculine gallery's thing. I think it is speaker after speaker. So, Jay?
It's an enormous honor to welcome you, Pat, into this space. Thank you very much for being willing to come and speak to us in a gathering like this, and for us to be able to work as the African Gender Institute with the Gender Equity Unit and the Department of Women and Gender Studies at UWC to offer some hospitality. I know you had to fight to find the vegan creature, but you found it. And it's a huge pleasure to have everybody here to come and listen to what it is that you're going to tell us and inspire us towards. I've just come, if I'm looking extra wrinkled this morning, it's because I've just come back from participating in a teaching seminar that markets itself as an international seminar on sexuality, and it's put together by the International Association for the Study of Culture, Sexuality and Society, and I was invited to be one of the people disseminating wisdom and blah-de-blah-de-blah. And I was telling Desiree, they sent me a curriculum. They actually sent me my slides. This is what you will say about sexual rights. Now, when I received that, I actually went into paralytic mode. I thought, can't. I actually refused to acknowledge the email. Why am I telling you this story? Because when I got there on Sunday, I discovered, I knew this was happening, that Desiree and Pat had been there before, that I wasn't the only person who'd been invited from South African State. there's other people that have been invited, and that Southern African space, and all the participants who were young, Southern African, NGO-based, some in universities, some struggling to find a way to do writing and research, were completely inspired, talking, absolutely enthralled by the ideas given to them by Patricia McFadden and Desiree. And I wasn't sure whose ideas were whose, because it just said on the board, joint lecture, Patricia McFadden and Desiree Lewis. And, but then they started talking about radical patriarchy and the meaning of the personal as political. And I could see that something had happened to that seminar space, which was completely transgressive, but also critical. And I want to thank you, because I just walked into that space and was able to benefit from what had been created. But that's very far from the first time it has happened to me in relation to Pat McFadden's work. The first time I really heard her speak, not the first time I'd read some of your work and heard about you, but the first time I really heard her speak was in 1997. Yes, I met her live in 1997. So it was Pat.
That's so awesome.
We were at a conference in Gaborone.
Oh, yeah.
It was a conference put together, I think Mary was there too. It was the conference of the NET, the Sexual Harassment Network conference. We were trying to put together a political network of people. It didn't matter who the people were. We weren't interested in their university identities, whether they were faculty or counselors or librarians or teaching staff or students or leaders. We didn't care about that. We cared that everybody there wanted to address the question of gender-based violence as it is lived on a day-to-day basis within institutional spaces and the way those spaces interact with the towns and cities and streets and homes around them. And it was a very conservative space. The University of Botswana had not been particularly hospitable to the planning. It had been enormously difficult to get everybody together. And Pat was the keynote speaker. And within an hour of her talking about the politics of being a body, of being a spirit, of being a heart, and being that in a whirl of intelligence, absolutely transformed that space into a set from a set of exhausted organizers and worried participants to being a space where something like political solidarity started to burble and didn't stop. And I knew then that I was in the presence of an extraordinary spirit. So Sometimes one looks across one's life and you say, well, actually, is there any sense to it? What happened when? And can you make a story out of these things? And then you get to stand here and get to remember and get to say thank you. So I believe I have to sit down now.
Yes,
this
please.
Is my introduction. This will be silly.
Thank you so much.
Wow. I promise you, since then, Pat McFadden, your ears, my
red.
But does it matter if I'm in Rwanda, or I'm in Australia, or I'm in New Zealand? I introduce myself as a gender diva.
Oh,
the compliments of my comrade Pat McFadden about these women, these feminist careerists, as Myanti calls them, who flip from country to country on the gender ticket. And they're out of touch with grassroots. But I, the New Men's Movement can attest to where they that I have my feet firmly on the ground, even though sometimes I'm in Rwanda. So Pat, it's been wonderful sharing time with you, but also, I think just using words like gender divas and the way you actually spoke to me really made us question even the whole role of the national gender machinery. And I think how many years later, some of us are still really concerned that we still actually have a gender commission. Because really, we really need to interrogate and maybe see how we can restructure this national gender machine into a meaningful structure that will actually benefit the grassroots and poor women. But without ado, I'm not going to be long, I just want to say that Pat revels in introducing herself as a radical black feminist. And she's a Southern African feminist who does not compromise on women's inalienable rights anywhere in the world, whatever struggle it is. She's born in Swaziland, but she's fitted in all the Southern African countries for the past 50-odd years, but also the United States and other countries. And her main work now is also the global work around sexuality and violation of women. So she's a well-respected feminist academic writer, and she's written incredible things sometimes that I think is even too radical for some of our feminist journals on the contrary, on the continent, Desiree, I think. But I think that the wonderful thing about Pat is that she makes us think, and she sometimes shocks us, and I think sometimes we need to be shocked out of our inertia of comfortable academia and also full-time activism. I don't want to be too long. She's written extensively, and everything has a question mark, as you write, or an asterisk. And I think that we really are privileged to be able to experience and share some of your gems, but also to set the debate and the ball rolling on. How do we actually promote feminism in this country that actually has become quite misogynistic, you know? And even though we have all these incredible policies, you know, that some of our gender divas have actually written, what does it actually mean in terms of changing people's lives, in terms of women's lives, in terms of challenging patriarchy, and in terms of just getting a better world? So at the moment, it's all very theoretical, and with Pat's inspiration here, we'll see how we can move closer to reality. Thanks very much. All right.
Okay, so,
yeah, I was wondering when I saw all your pages.
It's such a beauty,
isn't it? So without further ado, Patricia McFadden, the circle is yours, and for those who are outside the circle, please come into the circle.
Thank you, my sisters, every one of you, and especially those who have opened the path for me and democratized the site by sharing some of the things that we have in common and how we grow together as radical women. So I thank you. I don't operate alone, and this is not out of any set sort of, you know, religious or moral sense of humility. I think we're all very into ourselves as thinking women, and and some men. but as thinking humans, we do have a sense of ourselves. And I find that when we celebrate each other, we really we stimulate ourselves and each other to grow in tremendous ways. And so I hope my gift to you this evening will be stimulating, and that you will embrace some of what I'm saying or all of it. And of course, it goes without saying that I thank the organizers. I thank all the people who made an effort to bring me here and actually made it happen. Those of us who travel radically. We know that many sites are closed off to us. And in fact, it's a good thing, because it's so easy to pollute when it's wide open. You have to ask yourself, why do I have so much access to space, material resources, and other infrastructures that are fundamentally patriarchal when we haven't made the really big changes in all our societies? So I actually don't mind being kept out and told, we don't want people like you, you know, stay away. Because it reinforces the understanding that to be radical is worth it. It really is worth it. And so being here is a really precious gift for me, and thank you. I also want to thank you as an audience, because when I use my thinking resources, I glean from the energies of those with whom I am engaging. So I want to thank you for, before we even go beyond this point, for infusing the space with energies that are critical and or otherwise. So let me begin by situating myself cautiously. And I do so with a large dose of temerity. And I'm using the notion of temerity as a well-understood and deliberate sense of recklessness on my part within the terrain of South Africa as a convoluted and complex socio-political site, as a space that has been trampled over and upon by some for centuries, as well as being the location and home of an idea, a reality that has traveled with and accompanied many bright and courageous lives, present and past, and which continues to be endowed with the potential of becoming new and dignified through the courage of each generation that embraces the possibilities of being free. And one of the things that I've been trying to do with my life is to understand that freedom resides inside me, that I am what is made up, what makes freedom. And that unless I can actually embrace that, I cannot experience freedom. Nobody gives us freedom. You know, it is a gift that we give ourselves. And the ways in which we live our lives enhances that freedom and enables us to also enrich and strengthen freedom as the lived reality of every single human being who's born. And so that's why I feel a sense of ambiguity when I hear the generation that was born after the flags went up as described as the born free generation, because they're not born free. And it's part of the package of illusions that accompany the moment of independence and the shutting down of radical agency, radical aspirations, and the unlearning of resistance. Mm-hmm. So tonight I want to try and see if I can locate some of that in this terrain, in this national terrain and regional terrain, and also to try and see how we can start talking, and I'm sure we are talking in our own sites, about how to retrieve and reclaim this knowing to resist, how we know that resistance is essential to our existence, to who we become, and how we become those beautiful, beautiful creatures that have lived for over 2 million years and survived many calamities. Particularly for those of us who come from this continent where the first human being stood up and moved forward. So the very idea of movement and motion is embedded in being African. Mm. So being able to stand, if we're bowed over, we've tripped over, whatever, the call is to stand up and remember how to resist. And that's really the central gift of my conversation with you today. I want to declare my struggle credentials from the very word go, as unfashionable as that has become, and maybe, just maybe, this will deter the inclination that some might perceive me as impetuous and out of space and out of line from a narrow nationalistic sense of not being South African. Nationalism and patriotism are essentially about being confined to spaces within lines drawn by males, usually older males with power. My visitor status is persistent, not for want of having tried to be formally included in the new South Africa, a longing that was ruthlessly crushed by a formal, "we don't want people like you here" response in a letter from a former comrade ensconced in the state as a guardian of authentic South African pedigree in the immediate independence moment, who reminded me that I could not assume inclusion by virtue of having spent a quarter century in the African National Congress as a hard-working, often unruly, anti-apartheid activist. I wish I had counted the number of AK-47s that I moved across the border.
That was a thrill, I tell you.
But it was done. It was high-risk work. Nobody even noticed when people like myself, couriers, we were killed. The Boers hunted us down, and most of us didn't even appear in the TRC discussions. Nobody even remembered that the couriers were the ones who moved the arms and the comrades, mainly men, young men, who had been taught not to remember us. And their amnesia translated into the national amnesia of not remembering us, you know. But I handled an AK-47 many, many times. Often they were stacked under the beds of my little children, aged 7 and 8, and they learned not to say anything, but to sing the songs of the African National Congress, especially the Mkhonto Esizwe songs. So Dubuli Bono was a song that my children would sing in the back of the car on the way up the mountain to Steggy, to the eastern border with Mozambique. And today, it's high-risk lyrics, and it's actually on the way to being erased. It may be, it's contestable. I mean, is it just so important? But what's the larger issue about erasure? Is it about what somebody who is a nationalist provocateur like Malema says or chooses to say? Or is it about rewriting the script on what Southern Africa is, how it became something that engulfed and consumed 25 of my years, my best years, as I think about it as I age? So I console myself at having been ejected from the new South Africa as not being adequately South African, even though my two grandmothers were born in the South, in KwaZulu-Natal, on the Pongola border. But I console myself by actively insisting that I'm Southern African and that I have earned this entitlement, which is not yet a right situated in a regional legal structure that would be defined and which will serve the people of this region when it does happen. But nonetheless, it's an entitlement that I have earned. And to the displeasure of increasingly fascistic immigration functionaries at the borderlands, I traverse the region by road, often alone, refusing to be discouraged and dismissing caution about the dangers that await an older black woman alone on the highways of this dangerous but resilient terrain. And I love driving through South Africa. I drive for 2 days in between the trucks, you know, and the you know, I almost used an expletive. The masculinity that is associated with being in the public on those highways, with those men behind those machines. And it's like, you know, it's pure testosterone. And it's dangerous. Well, especially when you're an older woman, because you're nobody, they don't see it. In a little Toyota, you know, the invisibilization on the highways and the really aggressiveness of the police, the ease with which they will pull you over onto a shoulder of the highway, especially if you're driving a Zimbabwean registered truck, which I used to do, and the risks that you could just disappear into a police station, and by the time somebody finds out, all the damage has been done. So the challenges of becoming post-colonial lie in our understanding of the ways in which neocolonialism provides opportunities not only for black men and large numbers of black women and other women and men of color to ascend into the state and participate in the plunder, but also the ways in which the structures, the historical structures of colonials, of settler colonialism and colonial privileging remain inert but very, very, very volatile. They don't change, but they remain so volatile and are projected against the people, you know. When I'm driving down the highway, I'm one of the people. I don't have a parade of cars with blue, you know, buttons on the top flashing. So there's no security, there's no way that anybody can tell that I actually moved AK-47s for 5 years, took the risks. It's not written on my little Toyota or on my forehead. And the harassment, you know, it sometimes it has different impacts on me. I told those two policemen who pulled me over exactly what I thought about people like that. And I ran the risk of disappearing into a police station for a couple of hours or days. But I felt good. Because I said, I gave good years of my life for the possibility of driving across this country and not asking me for anything. And how dare you stop me and tell me that you're just checking on me? Huh? How dare you imitate the apartheid repressive structure and their representatives who harassed us and, you know, made it hell to be in the public on the highways. So the highways are really sites of struggle for me. And I don't want to stop driving. My aged father worries. I mean, you mustn't drive alone. You're an old woman. And this whole thing about you're an old woman. I'm like, what is this? I still drive, you know? But aging also changes in the contemporary moment. It also changes within very specific contexts of neocolonialism, you know? And that's another conversation that we really need to have, you know, about how we become depoliticized as we age, particularly as women who live in black bodies that don't conk the hair or try to imitate certain identities of privilege by blistering our skins, you know. And so I continue to lurk on the edges of South Africanness, hurling critical barbs at notions of exceptionalism, at claims of godliness, and of having cornered the market on reconciliation and redemption, and of course, contesting proclamations of black authenticity and black womanhood and the custodianship of what Africa will become via a neo-imperial and neo-capitalist agenda. You know, the whole thing about, structural justice. Now, when we think about it, I want to just take us quickly to what has happened recently. It's a terrible, terrible place, but I want to just tiptoe into it and ask us to bear witness to the no-fly zone farce and the ensuing debacle over Libya, which is a stark reminder to us all that feeling democracy and not thinking radically about the implications of being persuaded by liberals, who, by the way, are conservatives in straitjackets, read it the way you want in every way possible. The bulk of the people who view the television representations of Libya and what's happening there, who listen to the radio, have been persuaded to collude ideologically in facilitating the rampancy of neo-imperial impunity. And this is pushing us into the embrace of a recolonizing agenda that will cost our existence in the longer term. Anyone who's been listening to news programs, for example, SAFM, will know that we, the Africans, were outmaneuvered and outfoxed, courtesy of South African continental ambitions. And complaining of imperialist deceit, as though no one knows what was done, and that the reality of Libya is blatantly in our faces is a lesson that cannot be wasted. And I'm hoping that we'll talk about it. Because this old trick of mobilizing people's sense of outrage, and then layering larger, more hegemonic interests and agendas on that, is deeply, deeply problematical.